From WAMC in Albany, this is the Legislative Gazette, a weekly magazine about New York State government and politics. Your host is David Gastina, with political commentary by Dr. Alan Shartok, political scientist and professor emeritus at the University at Albany. Statewide distribution for the Legislative Gazette is made possible by New York State United Teachers, representing professionals in education and healthcare, online at nysut.org. And NISCASA, the New York State Coalition Against Sexual Assault, working to support men in their decisions to end sexual violence with the My Strength is Not for Hurting campaign, online at nyscasa.org.
I'm Patrick Donges, filling in this week for David Gustina. Coming up, the end of the 2012 state legislative session is being described by some as a political sophomore slump for Governor Andrew Cuomo. Karen DeWitt will tell us how his policy agenda fared, and we'll get analysis from our political observer, Dr. Alan Shartok. Plus, Pat Bradley looks toward November as U.S. Senate and congressional primaries wrap up, and Dave Lucas gauges officials' reactions to the U.S. Supreme Court's decision on the president's health care law. Those stories and more coming up on the Legislative Gazette. The recently concluded 2012 legislative session brought mixed results for Governor Cuomo, who's in his second year in the office. While Cuomo and lawmakers could claim credit for a calm and functional end to this session, the governor had to drop some of his original goals in order for that to happen. The Legislative Gazette's Karen DeWitt reports.
Governor Cuomo's second legislative session was far less dramatic than his first in 2011, when he convinced the legislature to authorize same-sex marriage, instate a 2% property tax, and close a massive $10 billion budget deficit. In his second session, the governor's record of achieving his stated goals was not as complete. Cuomo began in January with his State of the State message. The centerpiece was the building of a giant convention center in Queens, which Cuomo said would be the biggest in the world.
We believe we can attract $4 billion in private sector investment to build a state-of-the-art convention center at the Aqueduct Racetrack. It'll be all about jobs, 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 tens of thousands of jobs, building the number one convention center in the country.
The very next day, the governor revealed that the gaming conglomerate Genting had signed a letter of understanding with the state to construct the convention center. Several weeks later, Cuomo convinced the legislature to take the first step toward passing a constitutional amendment to allow more gambling in New York. But then, 5 months later, Cuomo abruptly announced that the deal with Genting had fallen through. He said the gambling company wanted exclusive casino rights for the New York City area, and he could not guarantee that.
They can't be in a position where they then have to compete with a casino in their backyard. And we didn't have a good way around that.
Cuomo's announcement came just before the New York Times published a story that said Genting and other pro-gambling forces had contributed over $2 million to a lobby group closely associated with Cuomo, the Committee to Save New York, in December of 2011, just weeks before the State of the State speech in early January. The governor also rescinded his threat to veto any redistricting lines that were not nonpartisan and done by an independent commission. And in mid-March, he agreed to new lines for the legislature that critics said were blatantly gerrymandered. During an all-night session, the governor issued special messages to rush through other parts of a larger deal to create a new pension tier and expand the state's DNA database. In contrast, the end of the legislative session took place mostly in daylight, and this time Cuomo refused to issue any special messages. The session concluded in the most orderly fashion in decades.
A decorum and a professionalism and a competence in government is what we've been trying to instill. And that's the way we want to close out the session.
The governor did trade order, though, for any last-minute agreements on major topics. He had to give up on a push to decriminalize public possession of smaller amounts of marijuana and other issues, including an increase in the state's minimum wage, championed by Democrats, also fell by the wayside. Cuomo did win agreement to reform state agencies that care for the mentally and physically disabled. Steve Greenberg, the spokesman for Siena College Polling, says a quiet end to the session can actually be counted as an achievement for the governor and lawmakers following years of chaos and dysfunction.
I don't think the voters of this state are necessarily looking for dramatic, historic legislation all the time. They're looking for state government to work for them.
And the governor is likely to get another chance to press his agenda with the legislature before the calendar year ends. There's been talk of pay raises for lawmakers that has not been completely ruled out by legislative leaders, perhaps laying the groundwork for more discussions on the governor's other unfinished items. In Albany, I'm Karen DeWitt.
Joining us now, Legislative Gazette political observer Dr. Alan Shartok. Alan, the 2012 New York State legislative session wrapping up with little acrimony, but also little fanfare, people calling it Cuomo's sophomore slump. What's your take?
I've heard that. I read it, I think, in the New York Times. But basically, I don't believe it's his sophomore slump. First of all, his numbers are in the stratosphere, and they haven't moved really at all. Number two, I think that what you see is what you get, meaning that a lot of people think that Andrew Cuomo, wanted, because he said he wanted, a minimum wage raise. I don't believe it, not for a second. I don't think he wanted it. I think if he wanted it, he would have gotten the state Senate to do absolutely what he wanted, because after all, it was he who saved the state Senate's keister in the first place. He said he was going to veto that reapportionment bill. He said it in his campaign, and then he turned around and didn't do it. Now, my feeling is he did it because he wanted to protect his Republican partners. He's a Democrat, all right, but he's more and more of a blue dog Democrat, meaning that he's conservative. If he had the liberals who control the Democratic conference, they would have spent more money. He didn't want that. It's what he ran against. And I believe that if he turned around to Dean Skelos, who is the Republican Party majority leader in the New York State Senate, the head guy, he would have said, Skelos, I want this and you're going to give it to me. And Skelos would have bent over and kissed his boots, because I believe that that's the relationship. So the fact that it looked like the Republicans wouldn't go along and therefore he was in a sophomore's slump is a bunch of nonsense. Not only that, everybody knows that on the table right now is the disgraceful request by legislators that they get a raise at a time when they have screwed all of the civil service workers to the wall, taken away pension rights for people who are coming in, and really oppressed them, as well as I just mentioned, all those people who would like just a little bit of extra in minimum wage so that they maybe could make $15,000, $16,000 a year, which is, you know, poverty. So he knows that he can get anything he wants out of them if he can only promise them that they're going to get a pay raise. And that is the way governors have been acting for a long, long time. So I don't believe it's a slump. I believe that he got pretty much what he wanted. I don't like everything that he does. That's clear. But I do think he's in charge. And the idea I find very obnoxious that he can't get anything done he wants to right now is just wrong.
Now, you mentioned redistricting and also the minimum wage that he said he wanted. Also, he had the marijuana legalization of...
I don't think he wanted marijuana reform.
Think it was pure politics?
This guy thinks he's going to be president in 2016. He's going to run for president in 2016. I don't think he wants that hanging around his neck that he's a New York druggy governor. I think he knows where his party is on this. People believe in it because there's no question that marijuana relieves pain. People want this kind of relaxation of the rules. So he's a Democrat, but he has to run. He has to get the middle class. He has to win Kansas. I don't think he wanted it.
Now, he came into office talking a lot about reforming the way Albany works in terms of ethics reforms. And in the past, this last session, we saw an all-night, overnight session passing some of the largest and most significant state policies of the year. And we also saw a lot of scrutiny on the Committee to Save New York, which is closely allied with the governor. Does he lose any credibility with voters?
He doesn't have a lot of credibility with me on those issues. However, with voters, we have not, as I've said before, seen a movement in terms of the people who appreciate what he said. You know, there's a lot of propaganda that goes into this. After the session, he got before the microphones. He took a bow. He said, look what we did. We did ethics in New York. Well, wait a second now. They set up a commission called Jay Cope, which has been labeled J Joke, because they don't seem to be able to do anything. You put the foxes in the hen house watching themselves, and that is really, it was a joke. And he also said to the Republican Party, because I want to get this thing done in the Senate, I'll let you guys who are in the majority now have the majority of picks on that commission, even if you're out of the majority. Well, it's one of the most astounding things I have ever seen done in Albany, and I've seen some really awful things done in Albany over the years. And then, yes, back to business, put them in their desks, let them bleat like sheep all night long, get them tired, and then they hold up their hands, I want to go home.
The U.S. Supreme Court coming down with the ruling on the Affordable Care Act, called Obamacare by some. What's the effect on New York State as far as politics?
Well, it's very interesting that you ask that, Patrick, because, as you know, a big part of this is setting up these exchanges and where people can buy their insurance. And the Republicans in the Senate have not been helpful about that. Now, some of this can be done by executive order, but I think the fact that John Roberts, the conservative chief justice, puts his imprimatur on this bill goes a long way to saying, hey, step aside, boys.
Our political observer, Dr. Alan Shartok. Alan, thank you.
You're welcome.
You're listening to the Legislative Gazette, a program about New York state government and politics. I'm Patrick Donjes, filling in for David Gustina. New York's politicians and major healthcare providers applauded the U.S. Supreme Court's decision this week to uphold President Barack Obama's landmark healthcare law. Shortly after the decision was announced, New York State Attorney General Eric Schneiderman released a statement saying that 1 million New Yorkers will soon have access to affordable health insurance coverage, while State Comptroller Tom DiNapoli called the ruling a victory for New Yorkers and Americans. While the state's executives praised the decision, some others, including some in the state's congressional delegation, weren't as happy with the ruling, as the Legislative Gazette's Dave Lucas reports.
Not everyone is pleased with the ACA. Ed Cox is chairman of the New York State Republican Party.
The Supreme Court has made it clear that the heart of Obamacare is a tax, a huge tax on the American people that has been and will be killing jobs here in New York State and in America. We need to repeal Obamacare, to jumpstart this economy and to get the investment going that will create the jobs in New York State and in America.
Congressman Chris Gibson says he respects the Supreme Court decision.
I'm disappointed with it, but I certainly acknowledge the constitutionality of it and respect the decision. You know, I think what we need to do now is work together to truly bring forward the reforms that will control costs, allow us to expand access while preserving quality care and our freedom.
Gibson's opponent in the coming election, Julian Schreibman, is hopeful the ruling will get Congress to stop bickering and start working together.
You know, like most upstate New Yorkers, I support covering children with pre-existing conditions, you know, stopping insurance companies from dropping coverage if they get sick, and in coming together to support seniors having stronger benefits and guaranteed benefits. So hopefully now, with this decision, we can stop playing politics with health care laws and Congress can start working on proper implementation and needed improvements so it can do what it was supposed to do, which is help the American people.
Priscilla Bassett co-chairs Sullivan County's Senior Legislative Action Committee. She sees the Affordable Care Act as a green light to improving Medicare.
We will work to get the most we can from the Affordable Care Act for people of all ages, at the same time that we believe Medicare for all would mean the expansion and improvement of Medicare for all ages in our country.
Nan Hayworth says the ACA is wrong and needs to be repealed and replaced.
So I would make health savings accounts the standard. I would make sure that people can buy insurance, affordable insurance across state lines so that there's choice and competition. I would have real liability reform because the cost of jackpot justice and defensive medicine add enormously and uniquely to the cost of health care in the United States. And I would have high-risk pools for people who really would have trouble finding insurance that they could afford.
For the Legislative Gazette, I'm Dave Lucas.
The ballots for November's statewide races were determined this week after primary elections were held. The Legislative Gazette's Pat Bradley looks at the results.
In New York State's senatorial primary, Republican Wendy Long defeated U.S. Representative Bob Turner and Nassau County Comptroller George Maragos. Long had 51% of the vote and won every upstate county. She moves on to face incumbent Democrat Kirsten Gillibrand in the general election. There were a number of congressional primaries. New York Congressman Charles Rangel narrowly defeated his closest challenger despite an ethics scandal and a newly drawn 16th district. In the new 18th congressional district, the five-way Democratic primary was won by Sean Patrick Maloney. He will face incumbent Republican Nan Hayworth. In the new 19th district, Julian Tribeman easily defeated Joel Tyner by 59% to 41%. Joel Tyner says it's critical that his primary opponent defeat incumbent Republican Chris Gibson.
We cannot afford two more years of Chris Gibson. Second of all, we actually won two counties, my home county, Dutchess County, also Otsego County. You know, we got over 40% of the vote with one-tenth of my opposition's campaign funding. A lot of people want a very clear, strong contrast with the opposition, you know, banning fracking. I even think it should be criminalized. Single payer, I think that should still be talked about and advocated for. Our campaign was about taxing Wall Street speculation to create jobs. I'm hoping that Julian can come around to embrace that. I think it was unfortunate that so much mud, lies, and garbage, frankly, was thrown at us in the last week, but that's politics in 2012. But we cannot afford two more years of Chris Gibson. So I'll be doing what I can personally to help Julian.
Gibson, who did not face a primary challenge, says his challenger lacks vision and direction.
I imagine today he's probably wondering why his total vote count was so low, remarkably low. 4% of registered Democrats came out to vote for him. He was the head of the Ulster County Democrats. He was the leader of that organization. And I would tell him to look at his message. His message is harshly partisan, it's divisive, it lacks vision and inspiration. I have to tell you that there's already too much of that negativity here in the Congress, and voters are tired of it. I remain focused on bringing people together to move our country forward. I treat everyone with dignity and respect, and firmly believe we don't need to divide this country to move us forward.
New York's new 21st congressional district is one of the largest geographically in the country. In his last race for Congress, Republican Matt Doheny lost after a primary challenger ran as an independent, forcing a three-way general election. This time, Doheny handily defeated Kelly Green in the primary and sees clear sailing in his second attempt to defeat incumbent Democrat Bill Owens.
Republican voters here in this vast new 21st congressional district chose me, but more than that, I mean, they chose to unite the Republican, the conservative, and independent party lines all with my nomination. Voters will have a clear choice of just one person having the R, the I, and the C lines, and that will provide a clear choice, a stark contrast between myself and our current congressman. And, you know, we had one of the 10 closest races 2 years ago where I came up short only by 1,900 votes. And our current congressman got elected with the smallest percentage of any victor in the country. So we are very excited and humbled by the opportunity to lay out my vision for the district and the country over the course of the next 4 months and give voters a clear choice on November 6th.
Tuesday's primary was also notable for low turnout. In Congressman Rangel's new district, the New York Times is reporting about 12.6% of eligible voters went to the polls and is also reporting confusion over the redrawn districts.
For the Legislative Gazette, I'm Pat Bradley.
You're listening to the Legislative Gazette, a program about New York State government and politics. I'm Patrick Donges, filling in for David Gustina. Hot weather calls for cold beer, and that means good business for New York's microbreweries. But as the Innovation Trail's Ryan Delaney reports, a lawsuit earlier this year almost caused New York's beer maker's Fizz to go flat.
Nick Matt knows the FX Matt Brewery in Utica like a second home. From an old catwalk, he looks down at its two massive copper kettles.
This was all done after World War II. These brew kettles are that old.
Matt was practically raised here. His grandfather started the brewery 124 years ago. And while you may not know the name FX Matt, if you're a beer drinker, you've probably heard of the popular Saranac beers it makes.
Saranac Adirondack Lager is a much more dry-tasting product. Saranac Pale Ale.
When Nick Matt started making Saranac in the 90s, there were only about two dozen microbreweries in the whole state. Today, the state liquor board recognizes 124 breweries, which is about half the number of wineries dotting the Finger Lakes. New York-made beer taps about $200 million in revenue each year, according to the New York Brewers Association. Growth was helped in part by a gift of sorts given by New York in 1991. Breweries got a waiver from having to pay excise tax and label fees. But Matt says that growth almost came to a halt this year. After a lawsuit by a Massachusetts brewery, a court deemed the waivers illegal.
On March 30th, they told us about this, and they said, start paying the excise tax effective March 28th. And, you know, everybody's like, you mean next year? No, 2 days ago. So, you know, it's kind of a shock.
The dollars break down like this. The excise tax would require breweries to pay 14 cents on every gallon they brew. If you remember from your college days, it takes more than 15 gallons to fill a keg. Plus, each brewery would have to pay $150 for each label or style of beer it makes every year. Matt says that would add up to $350,000 a year on his bottom line. For Rochester's Genesee Brewery, it would add up to $900,000. But it's even worse, relatively speaking, for the many smaller breweries and brew pubs in the state. That's according to David Katleski. He's president of the New York Brewers Association.
The margins are so slim in this industry, especially when you're dealing with raw materials that fluctuate based on how nice Mother Nature is to you.
Katleski makes 70 different kinds of beer at his Empire Brew Pub in Syracuse. Between the label fees and excise tax, he says that would mean having one less employee. Katleski just purchased 22 acres in nearby Cazenovia with plans to open a brew house and farm. But when he heard about the tax, he almost scrapped the plans and was contacting real estate brokers in Pennsylvania and New Jersey. But before deciding to move, he made some calls to New York politicians.
And I think the legislators and the lawmakers in Albany recognize that not only are we considering doing that, but other companies would be considering doing that as well, and they didn't want that to happen.
It seems lawmakers heard the call. In the waning days of the legislative session, they passed a tax credit that will reimburse brewers for most of the excise tax and label fees they now have to pay. Katleski says Albany realized it shouldn't cut off an industry that employs 3,500 people and is growing quickly.
My grandfather, when he put this brew house in.
Back in the FX Matt Brewery in Utica, Nick Matt says the jobs and revenue his brewery generates are important for a town that struggled the past few decades.
We're somewhat symbolic of this area. I think we're looked at as one of the kind of key things that this area is proud of. And I think people, when they go places and they see Saranac, they're really pleased that that comes from their hometown.
The neighborhood surrounding the Matt Brewery is dotted with empty warehouses and vacant buildings. But several bars and another brew pub also now line a neighboring block. FX Matt is in expansion mode too. The brewery is installing a massive green energy project that will generate 40% of its electricity, a sign the brewery doesn't plan on slowing down anytime soon. For the Legislative Gazette, I'm Ryan Delaney.
Support for the Innovation Trail comes from the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. The Innovation Trail is a collaboration between five upstate public media outlets reporting about New York's innovation economy. You can hear more at innovationtrail.org. And that about does it for this week's show. We had help from the New York State Public Radio Network. Copies of this program are available by calling 1-800-323-9262. That number again is 1-800-323-9262. Ask for program 1226, or you can listen or download our podcast on the web at wamc.org. Join us again next week at the same time for more news on New York State government and politics. For the Legislative Gazette, I'm Patrick Donges. David Gustina returning next week.
Statewide distribution for the Legislative Gazette is made possible by New York State United Teachers, representing professionals in education and healthcare, online at nysut.org. And NISCASA, the New York State Coalition Against Sexual Assault, working to support men in their decisions to end sexual violence with the My Strength is Not for Hurting campaign, online at nyscasa.org.